This is Jeff Blankford with the June 28th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. While many Americans may not take President Trump seriously, others like Washington's key Gulf allies, the Saudis and United Arab Emirates, do. It was apparently the approving nods by Trump and his well-heeled son-in-law Jared Kushner toward 31-year-old Mohammed bin Salman, son of Saudi's aging King Salman, before and during Trump's visit to Riyadh last month that led the king to shuffle the line of succession to his throne by demoting his 57-year-old nephew Mohammed bin Nayef and promoting the younger Salman to crown prince, where he is now in line to succeed the king when he passes on. It is the younger bin Salman who is the country's defense minister, launched a brutal air war in Yemen with the support of the Obama administration, and who apparently is behind the Saudis' efforts to isolate Qatar, its much smaller Sunni neighbor that has challenged Saudi Arabia for primacy in the Wahhabist Sunni world, and is currently home to the largest U.S. air base in the Middle East. The main allegation that the Saudis have made against Qatar is that it is funding terrorist organizations, among them the Saudis' one-time ally, the Muslim Brotherhood. That's true, of course, but for the Saudis, the original funders of Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and the Afghan Mujahideen, to make that charge is the epitome of hypocrisy. As with its war on Yemen, things have not worked out in the manner that the Saudis had anticipated. Rather than isolating Qatar, it has brought it closer together with Shia Iran, with whom it shares the world's largest underwater gas field, and with Turkey, which also has an air base in the Gulf Kingdom. Both of those countries have been supplying food and other supplies to Qatar in helping it counter the Saudi blockade. It's just possible that Trump, in offering at first full-throated support for the Saudis' demands on Qatar, which includes shutting down of its TV station, Al Jazeera, was not aware of the U.S. bases in that country. He has since tempered his tone to bring it closer to the efforts of Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who hopes to mediate a peaceful resolution to that conflict. To sort all that out and to delve into the U.S. and British roles in creating the terror organizations whose actions have torn apart much of the world since 9/11, I'll be speaking at 20 minutes past the hour with an expert on the subject, Dr. Christopher Davidson from Durham University in Northeast England. He's the author of a number of books on the region, including most recently Shadow Wars, The Secret Struggle for the Middle East, which will be also the subject of our discussion. Well, in case you may not have noticed, the United States has started a war with Syria. It's undeclared, of course, as have been all the instances of U.S. aggression in foreign land since our nation's founding. But what other explanation can one offer when an American fighter plane shoots down a Syrian fighter jet in Syrian airspace and President Trump's War Department claims it to have been an act of self-defense? It was just the latest attack on Syrian forces by the U.S. military, the most notable previously having taken place under President Obama last September, when just 2 days before Russian-American coordination in the fight against the terror groups in Syria was to begin, U.S. warplanes attacked a Syrian army convoy, killing more than 60 Syrian soldiers and wounding at least 120. American officials apologized for the mistake, but imagine what would have happened if the situation had been reversed. Well, Trump made his bones, as they say, by launching 59 cruise missiles at a Syrian Air Force base in April, supposedly in retaliation for what the president claimed, without proof, was a sarin gas attack by the Syrian Air Force on a Syrian town under the control of armed opponents of the government. On a previous program, I cited a former U.S. Army expert on the subject of chemical weapons who point by point took apart the administration's story. On Monday, as you may have heard, the White House announced it had information that the Syrians were planning to launch another chemical weapons attack, and Trump's press secretary, Sean Spicer, warned Syrian President Bashar Assad that if he, quote, conducts another mass murder attack using chemical weapons, he and his military will pay a heavy price, end quote. By an extraordinary coincidence, the White House statement came a day after an article appeared in the Sunday edition of Germany's Die Welt newspaper by veteran investigative reporter Seymour Hirsch. It challenged the Trump administration's version of events surrounding the April 4th chemical weapons attack on the northern Syrian town of Khan Shikun. Hirsch had to have it published in Germany when he couldn't find an American paper willing to print it. Subscribers to The New Yorker once could have expected to find his articles there, but for some years now, the esteemed literary magazine has been an apologist for America's never-ending wars. In his Die Welt article, Hirsch, drawing on inside sources, asserted that Trump was told that no evidence existed against the Syrian government, but that he ordered his generals to retaliate anyway. Marine General Joseph Dunford, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and former Marine General, now War Secretary James Mattis, ordered the attacks while apparently aware that the reason given was Hirsch's sources called a fairy tale. Trump's National Security Advisor, Army General H.R. McMaster, furthered the deception with the help of a compliant mainstream media, which, as former CIA analyst Ray McGovern points out, broke from its current tradition of distrusting whatever Trump says in favor of its older tradition of favoring regime change in Syria and trusting pretty much whatever the rebels, so-called rebels, claim. According to Hirsch's sources, the normal deconfliction process was followed before the April 4 strike. In such procedures, U.S. and Russian officers have been supplying one another with advanced details of airstrikes, such as target coordinates, to avoid accidental confrontations among the warplanes crisscrossing Syria, a process that the Russians say they have halted as a result of the downing of the Syrian jet. Back in April, according to Hirsch, Russian Syrian Air Force officers gave details of the flight path to and from the Khan Shikun in English. The target was a two-story cinder block building in which senior leaders, high-value targets, of the two jihadist groups controlling the town were about to hold a meeting. Because of the perceived importance of the mission, the Russians took the unusual step of giving the Syrian Air Force a GPS-guided bomb to do the job. But the explosives were conventional, not chemical, according to Hirsch. The meeting place was on the floor above the basement of the building, where a source whom Hirsch described as, quote, a senior advisor of the U.S. Intelligence Community told him, quote, the basement was used as a storage for rockets, weapons, and ammunition, and also chlorine-based decontaminants for cleansing the bodies of the dead before burial. At the moment, the U.S. has a base in Syria that was established by Obama, and it is home to what was supposed to be a limit of 503 soldiers who the public was told would be advising and training Syrian troops opposed to the government as well as ISIS. In some areas, those groups were allied with Syria's al-Qaeda affiliate, which has operated under a number of names, among them the al-Nusra Front. In March, while there was an estimated 200 U.S. servicemen stationed in Syria, the administration announced that 400 more were on their way. That would exceed the stated limit, but Pentagon officials refused to make known the number who are actually there. That there is no legal basis under U.S. or international law for a single U.S. soldier being in Syria, notwithstanding, they are ready for war. At the time, that's in March, General Joseph Votel, the head of the United States Central Command, told reporters that he was open to asking for more conventional military units if they are needed. I feel very comfortable with mixing special operations forces with conventional forces, General Votel said. That's the way we fight. Does anyone in or out of Congress care? Apparently not, since making war or intervening in countries that have never attacked or posed a threat to us is as American as apple pie, with the exception of the period of time between the end of the Vietnam War and the beginning of the first Gulf War, during which Americans were suffering from what official Washington and the military considered a debilitating disease. They called it the Vietnam Syndrome. The word, as defined by Webster, refers to a group of signs and symptoms that occur together and characterize a particular abnormality or condition. Indeed, the American people were tired of war, and a way had to be found to either cure them of their tiredness or make them indifferent to America's imperial adventures. The secret was something the war makers had in their arsenal all along, the decision by President Nixon in 1971 to eliminate the draft. It seems to have worked. In the summer of 1973, following Nixon's re-election, members of Congress who watched Nixon escalate the Vietnam War without their approval passed the War Powers Act, which required a president who ordered U.S. troops into combat to come back to Congress within 60 days to get its approval to continue the operation. Obama ignored it, as no doubt will Trump. I bring this up because of some history every American should know. When the subject of a War Powers Act was first raised in the Senate in June 1969, Senator Everett Dirksen from Illinois, known then as Mr. Republican, entered into the congressional record a list of all the instances in which a U.S. president had ordered troops into action without consulting the Congress since the U.S. had become a nation. The list compiled at Dirksen's request by the Congressional Research Service indicated that in the 193 years since our nation had been founded, excluding the world wars which were declared by Congress, American presidents had ordered U.S. troops to intervene on foreign soil, which included those areas of the continent that had not yet been captured and inhabited by indigenous Native Americans, over 250 times, a number that has likely doubled since. Reading through the list, which contained the date and brief description of what U.S. troops had done, is a sobering experience and should be required of all Americans, at least reading in every public school. I couldn't put my hands on my copy as I prepared for today's program, but there's one entry that has stuck forever in my mind. It was in 1824 that sailors from U.S. naval vessel burned the village of Greytown on Nicaragua's Caribbean coast to the ground to avenge an insult by the mayor of the town to the ship's captain. I did not attend, nor admittedly have I read or heard much about a people summit that took place in Chicago on June 10th and 11th, but I suspected intuitively, based on what I haven't witnessed over the past decade, that in the call issued for this gathering that was attended by 4,000, there would be no mention of stopping U.S. wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, or addressing U.S. imperialism globally. This past weekend, I went online and read the call, and I'm truly sorry to say that I was right. Among the multitude of important domestic issues that the summit was to address, there was nary a word about resisting our enduring wars or the very real likelihood that another one is on its way. That I found to be unconscionable is neither here nor there. It is what it is, a sad commentary on who or on what we are as a country and a people at this moment in time. I would like to believe that this issue and its absence from the call were raised by some who attended. Finally, as there appears to be no let-up in the hysteria about Russia's alleged meddling in the 2016 elections, and since the mainstream media and the New York Times in particular seem obsessed with finding a new way to degrade President Vladimir Putin and Russia virtually every day with stories that have nothing to do with the elections, it's worth taking a look at another election 20 years earlier in Russia, in which U.S. political operatives played a major and not-so-secret role. On July 15, 1996, the cover of Time magazine, which you could see online, featured a cartoonish Boris Yeltsin holding a U.S. flag with the headline, quote, "Yanks to the Rescue, the Secret Story How American Advisors Helped Yeltsin Win." It described how three Republican Party political professionals went over to Moscow and turned around Yeltsin's campaign when polls had his popularity rating at 6%. Their story was also featured on Nightline. The neocon organ, however, the Weekly Standard, strongly objected to that characterization, stating that to suggest American interference in the election was an insult to the Russian people. Quote, "They chose to downplay the greatest political event of the decade," wrote Stanford professor Michael McFaul, "the triumph of Democrats and democracy in the first direct election of a head of state in Russia in 1,000 years, and featured instead three American consultants who allegedly won the race for Boris Yeltsin," end quote. In the next sentence, however, McFaul begins to give the game away, suggesting that to give the credit to the three U.S. operatives is to, quote, "taint the legitimate achievement of Americans who have lived and worked in Russia for years to strengthen that country's nascent democratic institutions," end quote. Well, we have to read further in the article to find out what Americans he is referring to. "The Americans," McFaul wrote, meaning those mentioned in the Time article, "also claim that their initial task was simple education, campaigning 101, implying that their colleagues knew nothing about campaign tactics. This comment is at best naive and at worst insulting," said McFaul. Dozens of people working on Yeltsin's campaign had been through Campaigning 101 well before the American, quote, teachers ever set foot in Russia. Since 1990, McFaul trumpeted, the National Democratic Institute and the International Republican Institute have conducted hundreds of seminars, conferences, and exchanges on party organization, message development, focus groups, polling methods, television ads, and so on. And a think tank translated into Russian the coveted Republican National Committee Campaign Handbook, mentioned by Nightline as an election Bible, 4 years before these Americans arrived, these other Americans arrived. So we must conclude it wasn't those three Americans that Time and Nightline publicized who should be credited for Yeltsin's victory, but other American operatives who have been working in Russia far longer. It should be noted that the National Democratic Committee, National Democratic Institute and the International Republican Institute are components of the National Endowment for Democracy, a quote-unquote nonprofit agency that's funded by Congress under the Agency for International Development and thus can be considered part of the U.S. government. From its record, it can be said the National Endowment is its name, regime change is its game. It has been headed since its founding in 1983 by neocon Carl Gershman, and featured on its board is none other than fellow neocon Elliot Abrams, whose qualification for the position was apparently he's illegally providing weapons for the Contras in their efforts to overthrow the legitimate government of Nicaragua, for which he was indicted, then later pardoned by the senior George Bush. As you may have guessed, the National Endowment was on the scene before the coup in Ukraine. It stated in its resource summary for fiscal year 2013, the year before the coup, that, quote, the objective of the endowment in most of the countries where it is active in the Europe region is helping new democracies to succeed. For Eastern and Southeastern Europe, this goal is best met through these countries' accession to the European Union and to NATO, end quote. In the same paragraph, it listed Ukraine as its first priority in Europe. What is quite amazing is that the National Endowment was functioning in Russia a year after the Ukraine coup, but in July of 2015, it became the first so-called NGO to be booted out of the country as an undesirable. This is Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.